Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Magdalena Clough. Tonight, we continue our reading of A Key to Treehouse Living by Elliot Reed. The novel is written in the form of a glossary-style list, which our protagonist, William, compiles as a way to understand the world around him. Now, here's Trevor Rao, reading A Key to Treehouse Living.
Seasons. Kids learn about spring, summer, fall, and winter. These are all made up. These made-up seasons sometimes go by other made-up names. Within these four made-up seasons, there are countless other made-up seasons. Somewhere in fall comes the season of making hand turkeys with construction paper and brown finger paint. In winter, once the ponds have frozen, comes ice skating season. Summer is swimming season, though you can swim in other seasons if you don't mind being cold. Fall, pumpkin season. Pumpkins grow all summer, too, but their official season is the one when they get ripped off the plant. Anything can be a season if you say it is. Rafting season starts in late summer and runs through early fall, past the tail end of swimming season. If I ever raft in other seasons, rafting season will expand to include that other season. After rafting season comes smell of rotten leaves season. Sweater season stretches through fall, winter, and some of spring, depending on where you are. It was summer when my uncle got in the back seat of a police car, and in that season he was only wearing a t-shirt. When autumn came, that's when I started picturing him shivering in his concrete cell. By then, I'd given up thinking that strong daydreams were mystical visions from some kind of spirit realm. I even quit believing the one I had, on the bridge, before I got on the raft. The vision in which I'd seen River Jim. I told myself all the visions I'd ever had were ones I'd invented, and that I could imagine whatever I wanted, so I envisioned a prison sweater on my uncle and felt a little better with this made-up image. I envisioned the gypsies in the Florida Keys selling coral and shells on the roadside and painting the hulls of boats for money. I pictured El Hondero in Ohio, where he was at the tail end of digging season. I saw him digging alone, in the woods, leaves falling all around him, looking for the mother lode, and saw that he'd found not a single piece of mica, that he was suffering trench foot, and that his teeth were ground flat because he'd been living on acorns for weeks. I smiled, and then felt sad. Emotions have very short seasons. Standing in the yard of Jim's shack on the banks of the river, I imagined that I was my father, so many seasons ago, and I held my hands up and made a square with my fingers, put the river in the square, and the river seemed to run faster when I did that. When I dropped my hands, the river slowed back down. I heard the ice in Jim's rum runner, then I felt his hand on my shoulder. With that, the season of revelations reached its end, and I was ready to leave the river. Tangled line. Every line will tangle itself if you give it a chance, and everyone has been beaten by at least one tangle. Jute rope has a will, it wants to tangle itself. Line has a mind like an animal. Wet hair, the same. To untangle a tangle, your willpower must be more than that of the line. There are piles of orange extension cord tangled in weeds outside shacks on the banks of rivers. Let them lie. Take off. When something takes off, it doesn't necessarily take anything but itself off, and usually what it's taking itself off of is the ground, as in the case of a plane or a fleeing goose. But it doesn't have to. It can also take off down a road or down a river or through the woods or on a train. If you meet a sad-looking woman in a parking lot beside a car with one of its side-view mirrors broken and dangling, and you ask her, "What happened?" and she says, "He hit me and he just took off," you can be sure she's referring to another motorist rather than somebody taxiing around in an airplane. Although, there is a bruise on her face, and so you can't be totally sure what hit her, where she was when it happened, and how it happened. If you yourself have recently left the place where you were staying for the night, let's say a place where you could no longer stand to be, you will realize that someone at that same moment might be saying, "You just took off," in reference to you. You might see this as a coincidence. What takes off must arrive somewhere other than where it came from. If the woman beside the car asks your name and where you're from, and you tell her, because she has the eyes of someone nice, and then when she asks you where you're headed, you say, "Anywhere, as long as it's away from that river." She might take this as an opportunity to offer you a seat in her car. And the two of you might, together, take off. toy dog. A miniature version of a particular dog breed. There are very few toy dog mutts, see breeding dogs, because most toy dogs can't survive for long in the wild. Chihuahuas, on the other hand, a small breed by nature, yet not technically toy, are excellent survivalists and will often sire litters of mutts in wilderness dens. Toy dogs are made the size of toys by breeders who choose the runts of normal-sized dogs as breeding stock, then the runts of those runts, then the runts of those runts, and so on until what would usually be a mid-sized dog can now, even at maturity, be kept in a red leather purse. Toy dogs are hypervigilant and almost always on edge. They can look in two directions at once, possibly as an evolved defense mechanism, or possibly because their breeders tried to make too many changes over too few generations. If you get in a car with a stranger, see getting in cars with strangers, and a Pekingese toy dog in a red leather purse occupies the passenger seat, where the driver has indicated that you're meant to sit, it's good manners to take the bagged Pekingese on your lap and to stroke its quivering, rat-like head as the car takes off. Toy dogs are very sensitive and must be treated with tenderness. See, tenderness. Especially if the owner of the toy dog is giving you a free ride somewhere. Talker. Someone who starts talking and doesn't stop for a long time, frequently moving from one subject to another and talking about that second subject for a while before continuing to yet another subject without once taking a break. There are several sub-varieties of talkers. Some you'll be able to understand and others you won't. Kind of like radio stations. Talkers will go on talking whether or not you're talking back or even listening. Some talkers are people who have recently spent a lot of time alone or have something very important to say, and once they have, they'll be quiet. These are the quick tail talkers. Compared to some other people I've met, the night patrol officer was one. Compared to some people, he was easy to listen to. River Jim, on the other hand, was not so easy to listen to. His talk was typical of the ruminations of the elderly. It traveled across time, went from place to place, name to name, and thing to thing. In a 5-minute span, I heard him talk about President Nixon and how to trap beavers and the Kansas City Royals, and why the bacon at the dollar store was going up in price. A talker would be easy to understand if you had some reference guide you could use to decipher him, but usually you don't. You knew River Jim expected you to know something about what he was talking about when he leaned in, gave your ribs a little jab with his elbow, and laughed in such a way that it would be bad manners not to laugh along with him. Sabi Juarez, whose car got hit in the parking lot just before I got in it, was an easy listening type talker. She had a sharp Mexican accent, the consonants were all sticky and bouncing around her teeth, and she sometimes dragged a vowel way, way out. Sabi was also fun to watch as she talked. Her hands most of the time were somewhere in the air near her head, even when she was driving. Her hair was charcoal black and very curly, just like Elondero's. Her fingernails were a bright red with no chips taken out of the paint, and they went in and out of her hair, which shook and swept like a flock of birds or something as she drove me along and fluffed it and talked. Sabi told stories about her ex-husband and his obsession with conspiracy theories, his terrible habit of sleepwalking, and her terrible luck with cars. She talked about her telemarketing job and the people she worked with, how they stole things from her cubicle, how she deflated their tires as revenge, how she'd had terrible bad luck with her first car, a Chrysler LeBaron, and how she'd vowed, at age 16, never to spend over $300 on either a car or repairs for a car, because anytime you spent money on a used car, you were gambling, and she hated gambling. How she hasn't to this day gambled on anything but scratch-off tickets and on cars, because gambling on cars and scratchers isn't real gambling technically. And though she'd had mostly bad luck with her cars, she'd had some good luck too, like the one Jeep that ran for 10 years. The car we were in, a station wagon with hail damage and a cracked windshield, ran fine, but now it had a side view mirror missing because some gringo in a silver pickup ran right into it and just took off shortly before I walked past Sabi in the parking lot. She asked me again if I'd seen him, the guy who did it, and I said again that I hadn't, but I'd heard it, because I was close by but focused on counting the number of squabs on the power line. There were white squabs, albinos, a good-sized population. There were black and brown squabs, too, and I was pretty sure there was at least one blue squab up there on the line. I asked if she'd ever eaten squab, and she said no, but chicken teriyaki was her favorite food. She asked me questions about my life and seemed to find what I said wildly interesting. When I couldn't answer a question, she supplied an answer for me. Trial database. If you break the law and you get taken off to jail, it can take quite a while before the court gets around to making a solid decision about how long it's going to keep you locked up before it gives you your trial. When it decides what day it wants you to go on trial, it publishes the date and time on a trial database, which you can look up online. Sabi's apartment was at the end of a cul-de-sac in a suburb where there were dozens of other two-story apartment buildings that looked just like hers, all joined together side by side in front of a deep forest of sycamore and oak trees. Her computer monitor was on a desk next to a cushion where the Chihuahua was sitting, chewing on his stick of leather, a little bell on his collar jingling as he chewed the mud-colored leather stick until it was white and spitty and flat and he couldn't eat it. Sabi showed me how to look through the trial database online. Her ex-husband, for instance, had a trial in a month. She planned on going there and telling the judge to lock him up forever, but maybe she would tell the judge to let him go. She couldn't say for sure. It all depended on whether or not she'd forgiven him by the time of the trial. When we looked up my uncle's name on the internet, we found out that he was going on trial in a week. Telenovela. Spanish for a TV novel. A telenovela is a TV show where people have their lives ripped apart by love. All the major emotions play out in the telenovela. Jealousy, mortal betrayal, coincidence, homicide, little league, mating, expectation, boredom. Telenovelas come in weird, dreamlike, glittery color. The women wear lots of makeup. If you don't speak Spanish, you won't be able to understand what the telenovela people are saying, but you can gather what's going on from their tone of voice and by watching what they do. Even the Chihuahua seems to understand when something important is happening, but this is probably because he reacts to the way Sabi is reacting to the plot. The Chihuahua gives either a whine or a yip depending on Sabi's reaction. Telenovelas are more interesting to watch if you're watching with somebody who fills you in on some of the important words here and there because she knows Spanish and is, for some reason, interested in making your telenovela experience a more pleasurable one. Even if you'd be happy to just watch the melodramatic actors walk around getting emotional in their glimmering light, even if you could just sit there and let the Spanish wash over you, it's bad manners not to act riveted by the translation of a woman like Sabi Juarez, a woman who has been kind enough to offer you her couch and who fed you a piece of chicken teriyaki with her chopsticks earlier. Testing for lice. If you're a nurse at an elementary school and you hear from one of the teachers that a louse was spotted on a desk in the first grade classroom just a few minutes ago, you must test everyone for lice. This is best done with rubber gloves and chopsticks. You must summon all the first graders and have them form a line outside of your office. Then you must check their scalps, one by one, using your chopsticks to lift the hair and look beneath it. You will find some children more cooperative than others. Some will be angry. Some will protest at the sight of you with rubber gloves and chopsticks. Others, the kids who never get a tender touch from their parents or from anyone else, will seem to enjoy the touch of your chopsticks. I remember closing my eyes and feeling her chopsticks in my hair. I remember the feeling was ecstasy. The chopsticks, her hand keeping me from swaying, her breath on my neck. The darkness, because my eyes were closed and I had entered a state of deep relaxation. And then the sound of her voice telling me to go on, move it. I remember walking around to the back of the line. Taking gifts. It's great to get gifts sometimes, but other times it can be not so great. By taking a gift from the wrong people, you can find yourself in debt. This means they can ask you to do stuff you don't want to do, and you'll feel like you have to do it. Taking gifts from strangers, including the gift of hospitality, is always a gamble. All you can do is hope that the gift giver doesn't ask for repayment that you can't offer. If your uncle gives you a radio, and if you know that your uncle is basically a good person, then you can take the radio and use it in your treehouse without worrying that he'll come by asking you to clean the gutters of the mansion. If a little boy you don't know offers you his milk carton, and the two of you are in the cafeteria at a bunkhouse for boys and girls who are wards of the state, it should occur to you that this milk carton gift is meant as a payment for your protecting him. If a woman you just met in a parking lot offers you her couch to sleep on and take out Chinese food for dinner once you get there, and on top of it she lights a joint in the living room while you're watching telenovelas, it might occur to you that she'll want more than for you to run chopsticks through her hair. Temptation. For the toy dog, there is no temptation as strong as the sardine being dangled above its head. It must battle its wild dog genes with the good manners it has been taught over the years, and it will wait, fixated on the sardine, until its master says, "Good boy, take it." Or this. you're in a financial crisis, you're out of money, your mansion has a huge insurance package covering fire damage, all you have to do is build a fire inside and cash in. Or you're living beneath a bridge over a river. You dream of floating down the river, but you're not sure how. Then one day a bunch of barrels wash ashore from someplace upriver where they're manufacturing a substance that goes in those barrels. When you fortuitously see the pile of barrels, see, meeting fortuitously, floating in an eddy of water by the banks below your bridge, you'll be tempted to lash them into a raft. All jumps are in some way tempting. All voids beckon. When you look out the window of your treehouse at the ground far below you, the idea of falling that far is tempting because you've never felt what it feels like to fall that far. If the events of the past few days have run you down, let's just say, as an example, that your raft was obliterated, you were arrested, and you learned that your father had committed suicide, your willpower will be sapped, and temptations that appear will overpower you. If you're alone in a house with a woman you hardly know, a woman who was the age you are now on the day you were born, and this woman makes it clear that she would like it if you took her clothes off, how tempted you feel to take her clothes off will depend on the answers to a number of questions. Is she nice? Does her house feel comfortable? Does she seem like a daddy in a bad way, or does she just seem lonely because her husband recently left her to be with a woman he met at his work? When Sabi parts the beaded curtain between the living room and her bedroom, and she's wearing a nightgown, how do you feel? Do you want to know what it feels like to have sex? Tokyo Sonatas. Amazing, beautiful compositions for the synthesizer and marimba produced in the 1970s by a group of scientists and artists in Tokyo, Japan. The Tokyo Sonatas are only available on a vinyl record I haven't been able to find anywhere except in a crate in Sabi Juarez's living room. Genius is random. Shows up like a submarine and disappears, is what Sabi said. Genius hit the Tokyo people hard in 1974. I'll never forget hearing the beautiful sounds of the Tokyo Sonatas at Sabi's house. I use the word beautiful for the Tokyo Sonatas, and the word beautiful has, so far, appeared 6 times in this key. But I have never properly defined it. I've never understood what the word beautiful means. But it's something like this. Everything you know, all the names of things, they're coming to a point. In the middle of the night, before you and Sabi take the dog for a moonlight walk, she has you hold him while she tenderly slips his 2 back legs and then his 2 front legs through the holes in a thin red sweater. She says, "Beautiful," and you put the dog down. Tenderness. See the woman at the park holding a baby, bouncing the baby lightly in her arms? That's tenderness. You and your pal Ned are running through the woods, and Ned falls and skins his knee on a rock. He limps the rest of the way to the treehouse. He's trying not to cry, and blood is running down his leg. After you get the band-aids from the treehouse wound kit and put one on his knee for him, you must pat down the band-aid with tenderness. If you wake up in a bed with a woman, treat her tenderly, and she will do the same for you. Don't leave early in the morning without saying goodbye, especially if the night before she tenderly held you in her arms as you told her all about your life. She listened. That was tender of her. Still, it's tempting to sneak away. The sunlight of crepuscular dawn, when it touches your sunburned face, is tender. Toiletry bag. Bags that hold the things you normally use in bathrooms. Toiletry bags are small, made of shiny plastic fabric, and covered in designs. Toiletry bags are used when you're on the road, so that everything is in one place when you stop at a bathroom. If all you have is a toothbrush, you don't need a toiletry bag. If you're floating down a river on a raft, the best place for your toothbrush is on a string around your neck, so you can find it in the dark and it doesn't get lost overboard. If a woman has a toiletry bag in her hand, car keys in her other, a backpack full of clothes slung over one arm, and a toy dog in a red leather bag slung over the other, let's say you're sitting in her kitchen eating a bowl of cereal when she comes in with her bags and her car keys, you can be sure she's planning to go somewhere. And soon. And that she intends to take you with her. Tense. A toy dog meeting 2 full-grown German shepherds it has never met before. The toy dog will be tense. Tense is the opposite of relaxed. Tense can be a state of mind, but it can also have to do with the space of time. A tense moment, written in the past tense, might be this. The warden of the bunkhouse, Wilson Carmichael, held in his hands a little snapping turtle that he'd pulled from the sheets of the bunk belonging to a boy named Ernesto. And as the little turtle snapped in the air, hissed, and flailed its webbed feet, Wilson Carmichael looked around at the gathering of orphans and said, "Who put this in Ernesto's bed?" A tense moment in the present tense. Present, because it's not yet a memory when you say it. "I can't go on a road trip with you right now, Sabi. I'm sorry." And when you say it, she's standing there with her floral toiletry bag and her backpack of clothes and her car keys and her toy chihuahua and a map of the southwestern states she had spread out on the table earlier. Deserts, Anasazi pueblos, every kind of Indian artifact, slick rock canyons, I know you'll love it, she said. A tense moment, begun with a sentence in future tense. I will get on that Greyhound bus after all, take it back to where I came from, tie up some loose ends, and get on with my life. Tying up loose ends. Picture an old net lying in a patch of weeds beside an old shack on the banks of a river. Imagine it's the kind of net that has weights woven into it. The kind of net you throw into a body of water by twisting at the hips and flinging it like a big disc. The kind of net that, when thrown like this and then pulled back ashore, is meant to come up filled with fish. Imagine spreading out this old net, untangling its many strange tangles. You'll need a flat, quiet, weed-free place to do this, and you'll need plenty of time to work. Imagine this old net lying flat on a driveway. Imagine that this net has a number of large holes, places where mice ate their way through it or where fish burst through, holes from where the net got caught on a submerged log sunk deep in the mud. Then imagine you have a spool of new line, a sharp knife, and the whole day ahead of you. Imagine that each little square of this net is a memory in your head, a memory of a time something happened, or a memory of something you heard somebody say once. When you think about the sequence of things that happened to bring you where you are today, it's like you're looking at a hopelessly tangled, useless net. Let's say you're sitting at a bus stop, wondering what the hell you're doing. What am I doing? That's an unanswerable question, and to ask it of yourself can make you feel like you're looking at a tangled net on the banks of a river teeming with fish. The only thing to do, in that moment, is to work with your line and your knife, square by square, repairing the mesh of your net. When at last all the holes are gone, it's time to tie up the loose ends, the places near the edge of the net, close to where the weights are. Once this is done, all you have to do is learn how to cast. Typewriter. A machine that writes type, used by writers to make documents that look official. You may be the greatest writer of all time, but until you have a typewriter, your work will not be taken seriously. Sabi, when I told her I wasn't going to go along her tour of the Southwest, when I told her that she had her important business and I had mine, and we both needed to go forth alone, took it pretty well. "At least let me take you to the bus stop," she said. And I said, "Of course." And before we got in her car, she put a boxy leather case on the kitchen table, a case with a shiny metal lock and a rigid frame, and she told me to open it. Inside the case was a typewriter. She showed me how to load the paper in the top and twist the feeder until the paper came back up. Showed me how to return the paper to the start of a new line. Ultramarine. The bluest shade of blue. Bluer than this, and you're going into purple. Less blue, and you're headed to gray. And from there, you could be heading anywhere. The roofs of stucco buildings in Greece are ultramarine. In crepuscular light, look up, find the first star to appear in the night. It will be in a sky that is still blue, a darkening patch of daytime sky. That's where you'll glimpse ultramarine. The best place to find ultramarine is through the tall, gently vibrating glass windows of a Greyhound bus in late summer. Ushered in. When somebody puts his hand on your back, pushes you gently through a door, and closes it behind you. The only way I can come up with a reason for my father's suicide is if I make one up using what I know about myself. The reason will come from my genes. My father waded into that water because not even his photographs could show people the world as he saw it. And because he missed my mother. And because he realized that the one thing he really knew how to do couldn't help him do what he wanted to do. At that point, he decided that death would be better for him than life. When he made that decision, he also decided something for me. He decided his being dead would be better for me than his being alive. I will honor his wishes and believe he was right. I will have him silently standing behind a closed door that's somewhere behind me. Ululate. Sounds something like an operatic falsetto, but is not. To ululate is to make high-pitched, strange noises with your throat and lungs. People ululate when they're sad about something. Women from the Middle East are the most famous ululators, though they can't be the only ones. If you're watching the news on a TV in a Greyhound station, and a reporter is giving a live dispatch from a town in the Middle East that was bombed to rubble a day earlier, and behind the reporter are the people whose homes were destroyed, and they start to ululate, all of a sudden you'll want to cry, because although your luck isn't the best, really, you would, if you could, give some of your luck to the ululators. All the things you've clung to might seem senseless in the face of what's on the television. You'll realize that nothing you could say is as important as what's being said by the broken-hearted mother on the screen. You may think it's a coincidence that ululate starts with a U and that you've learned its meaning at a time when you're feeling so close to Z, and then, outside, in the park across from the bus stop, you see a man atop a unicycle juggling apples for a group of children. When you're on a bus that's leaving the station and you're waving goodbye to a newfound friend who just dropped you off, you may, in your mind, be ululating. Underripe fruit. Fruit that's not ready to eat yet, but that in some situations you must eat anyway. Let's say you were in a rush to get on a bus, that the doors of the bus were about to close, and you needed to get on that bus because you needed to go where that bus was going, but your stomach was grumbling, and all you had was a little bag of clothes, a toothbrush, a camera, and a typewriter. Let's say that at that point you spot a withered old apple tree behind a bench, where some old men are awaiting a bus of their own, and you dash over to the tree, leaving your things on a seat by the window in the bus, whose doors are about to close, and though the driver says, "We're leaving now," you blow past him and run flat out to the tree, snatch three apples, and run back up the steps of the bus and through the door, which snaps shut behind you. You then sit down and bite into the first of your apples, but your teeth barely sink through the skin and the apple meat breaks off like a tiny coin in your mouth, and the underripe taste sends a shock of pain to the gland beneath your left ear.
You have been listening to A Key to Treehouse Living, a novel by Elliot Reed, read by Trevor Rao. This episode of The Bookshelf was produced by Chris Massini and me, Magdalena Clough. Music by Dr. Turtle. Executive producer is Vern Windham. You can find this and other past episodes of The Bookshelf online at SpokanePublicRadio.org.